Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Game Dev Unchained, the number one podcast about game development and the lifestyle thereof. I am your host, Brandon Pham, and with me, a special friend, an early investor, Daniel. How are you doing, Daniel?
I'm doing fine. Happy to be on. I think three of the companies I've been involved with have been on, so now it's finally my turn.
Yeah, it's finally your turn. I was actually finding that pretty surprising that I haven't had you on. We've known each other for so long, partied like together to at background. GDC. Yeah, you seem to always like come out of the shadows once every time I need a great guest. So before I get started, this is the part of the podcast where I ask you, our guest, to talk about yourself, where you've been, where you're at, where you're heading.
Okay, I mean, I can do the medium version. I am a finance guy. I worked in, started my career in banking, finance, and kind of came into gaming because from an investment angle. It was before gaming was super popular as an investment, and me and my friend, we were like watching games on Steam performing really well, having really good sales, and the companies behind them, they were like their stock, you know, their publicly listed stock, Swedish gaming companies, they were doing nothing. And I remember I went to an interview for like a analyst role, you know, like an investment analyst role, and you're always expected to present your best case. And I was talking about Starbreeze back then because Payday 2, which was just coming out, was selling so well. And I'm like, this is going to be so good for them. And it's crazy because you can see it, the Steam stats, you can see it, that it's doing well, but the stock is doing nothing. And the guy who I was presenting to was like 50 plus, and he was like, what are you talking about? You know, this, is this something I can touch? Or and that's where I kind of understand, okay, there's an opportunity here, because everyone that's above 50 in investment, they have no clue what's going on here. And especially because you have like, especially when the companies are in the early days, the companies were quite small. So they had maybe one game every 3 years. So they had like 2 years without revenue. And that was like a nightmare for traditional investors. So that was like a really big opportunity. So that's how I got into it, with some early investments in game companies, and then transitioned into game technology. And the transition basically happened by chance. I came across Quixel or Teddy through like a random meeting. I didn't know what they were doing, and he was presenting what they were doing. I'm happy to talk more about that amazing journey and that amazing company and those amazing founders, Teddy and Vakar. But basically, after meeting him for 15 minutes, I decided I'm going to take 100% of my money and borrow another 100% and invest everything into this company. And that's what I did. And that was Quixel. I think that was in 20, I can't even remember now, but about 3 years before they were acquired by Epic Games. And I worked there through the whole time. Basically from never having done anything in gaming. And 2 years after that, I, you know, sat in a meeting room with Tim Sweeney, which was pretty insane journey. And since then, I mostly invest in game technology, deep game technology. Some people say, you know, you're investing in picks and shovels, but I invest in the guys who make the shovels. It's like even early, you know, some of the companies, it's like the, you know, the really the it's before the engine core. So like Quixel and some of the other companies that you have had on, like Elias Software and Adnan from Polygon Flow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, man, you have a very interesting journey. I think, of course, I would love to kind of spend maybe the first third about your journey with Quixel, because it seems like it was your big foray into it and a huge success story there, obviously. And then through that, was able to kind of figure out and have a firmer grasp about this investment world in games too. So let's go ahead and get into that, and we'll talk about other touch points. Even with you beginning and saying that people above 50 didn't have like a good perspective of what games were doing and what games were becoming, this past year and a half, if anything, the pandemic was the craziest year I felt for acquisitions and just Epic buying company. It just seems like every month there was like huge amount of news of acquiring companies. What was, I guess, your overall perspective of that before we dive deeper into your history? Like, as an investor, what was happening the past year that made games so interesting to investors all of a sudden, where it felt like when you started, there was no interest?
Yeah, just to, when I'm mainly talking about Europe and where I'm from, Sweden. I think in the US you've had EA and other big gaming companies on the stock market for longer, so yeah, investors might have a better, but in Sweden it was, but this was like 5 years ago, 5-6 years. So now it's, everyone is in gaming. It's like you cannot not be in it. I mean, during the last year, I think every trend got accelerated, and gaming was already a strong trend, and it got accelerated further. We jumped a couple of years ahead on where we would have been. One investment I had, exploded several 100% up. It's a company that makes racing wheels, the hardware. When Formula One and all of the racing season got halted, and all the Formula One drivers went home and started racing on the computer and streaming it, and everyone was getting into it. It was like the wildest explosion in home simulation equipment and home sim building, and that just blew up and is still blowing up. So everything, I think, got accelerated. And but if you're, and the M&A boom, I think that's like a derivative of the increased interest in it. I mean, what is happening is that there are listed companies that are valued quite highly, and then there are unlisted companies that have games, and kind of the investors in the listed companies, they are more or less applying a pretty high valuation to the revenues. It's a great time to be have a game which makes revenue, because you have many, many, many options what to do with it, even if it's like seen as a mediocre game. Because if you're in a studio, you're never sure about your next success. I mean, you worked on AAA titles. You worked on Call of Duty. Mm-hmm. But even there, you are not 100% sure that the next release, even if you think it's the best, that is it going to be well received? Is it going to outsell the last one? So maybe if you're in a studio, maybe you feel at best, maybe you feel 50-50 about your chances for your next. But the investors now, they are, ready to apply a much higher probability of future success, maybe 90%. So if an investor comes to you and says, I'm ready to offload all of the risk, we really think your next game is going to be successful, then you're going to take that risk, you're going to take that opportunity. And I mean, some of these companies now have so many titles. So as long as a few of them become big, it's a portfolio that it can work. Obviously, if some of the bigger acquisitions are not going to pan out, it's going to be a problem. But
So there seems to be two sides of the coin right there, right? Obviously, traditional game methodology of like, it's a big payday if it works, it's a big loss when it doesn't, but you don't know until 3 years later. So there's always a huge risk with that. The game business has gotten better with their monetary business, the mobile, free to play, Fortnite, you know, where it's more daily revenue streams rather than that. So that seems to be fixed. But of course, there's a huge swath still of these development for a long time and then movie release, blockbuster day or not, right? And I don't think that's going to go away for a while. You did mention, like, you know, bigger companies with known proven IPs have a better chance because they have like, you know, their the time frame of releasing something is a lot shorter. So that makes sense, right? They have a bigger chance of playing the lottery. So the other side of that I want to ask specifically are the newcomers, the ones that don't have that first IP yet, that have a lot of prospects. And you mentioned a little bit about, you know, how people plays a big part of who you invest and what you invest. How does that play into factor? Of course, we're probably talking with lesser money, but, you know, there's still a lot of risks, right? How is that looking for the smaller developers?
To be honest, I don't invest that much in content, actually. It's mostly game tech, so I'm not the right person to talk too much about how that works. But, you know, how the due diligence on the people is done. But, you know, traditionally, especially in the US, when you see acquisitions, it's like someone is buying the best of breed, you know, like Activision buying King or EA buying Codemasters latest deal. So they're buying like the best in that segment. But what we've seen a lot from Scandinavia is that there is interest in buying kind of the mid-tier players just because they have a game, it generates revenue, and the stock market values that revenue very high, you know, and the guys who are at these mid-tier companies, they can both cash out and participate by getting some shares in the acquirer in the future. And the acquirer, you know, if you buy 50 mid-tier games, you're gonna have a pretty big portfolio, which hopefully is gonna not be so dependent on the hits because you have so many. You have like 50 mid-tier titles, and a few of them can fail and a few of them going to outperform, and the average is going to be good.
One last question before I dig back into your history. You know, there's some acquisitions, like you said, that make sense, right? Where EA buys Codemaster, Microsoft buying ZeniMax. You know, these are acquisitions that, yeah, of course, right? They're growing the portfolio. And then there's some that, if you want to comment or not, I don't know how close you are, but like with like Daybreak Studios was something that, you know, happened across the radar middle of last year. And that's a game studio that hasn't had a hit for 5+ years, and what they were announced were unappealing, but somehow they went through all those troubles and were able to make it out with an investor in hand. Like, so in those type of situation, like what is the play there, where publicly, at least it didn't seem like there was much, but I mean, privately there seems to be a lot.
I don't know too much about the specifics, but what I can imagine is because they have a you know, games as a service, games. So they have games that, even though they haven't had a smash hit in, you know, past few years, they are still have a few games which generate a steady stream of cash flow. And if the shareholders or the investors in the acquiring company are valuing the company at, you know, 10 times earnings or even more, I don't know, I had to check it out, then they can pay, you know, pretty good just to get that earnings into that company. And then I have to imagine there are a few talent there which you know, maybe can be repurposed in the organization or so, but I think these types of acquisition will mostly happen with companies with kind of an MMO or games as a service type of business, where you have kind of a loyal fan base, a steady stream of cash. If you're a hit based developer, you know, you had a hit last year and now you're developing a completely unknown new IP and you currently almost have no sales, then you're not going to be very attractive to these types of acquisitions. I mean, you might be attractive for other reasons.
I think this is the right time to kind of go back into the history a bit. So you said you got into the world investing for, well, Payday 2 was kind of like your intro to that, and that started off content, but now you're exclusively just game tech as where you put your money in. And then, you know, the meeting with Teddy and Quixel and understanding that and taking 100% of your money and borrowing 100% more. What is it exactly that made you kind of switch towards game tech, where you felt content was still not interesting enough or too risky for you to kind of get around?
I think Quixel was very specific, because when I met them, they had been building Megascan's library for about 5 years, you know, just going around and scanning and funding it through Quixel Suite. And not having a lot of, not having put a lot of time, even the product Megascans wasn't really done by then. The pricing wasn't done and so on. And I think that specifically when I heard that they've been doing this for 5 years, no one else has been doing this, and it's a real time saver. And at that point, they had just had that partnership with Disney. And Megascans was used in the Jungle Book, which won an Oscar for best, I think it was best digital, you know, something within VFX, like a VFX Oscar. And they had used a lot of Megascans. So for me, that was like a proof of concept. And I said, okay, we just need to figure out, you know, how to structure this. And we were able to, they recently hired a guy from Simplicon, who was you know, helping them out with the business model, and I said, you know, with just some extra funding, we just have to put the pedal to the metal, and I think this is going to be, everyone is going to have to use this because it's such a time saver. And but during the way, you being a middleware is always a bit of a struggle, because okay, we're doing all this time saving, but it's, you're not never going to get paid for 100, you know, even 50% of the efficiency you do. It's like, you know, you're using Word, but you're not comparing that to a typewriter. You're not, then you would have to pay millions for a Word license. So you're only going to cash a fraction of the value you deliver as a middleware. And in this business, you always have, you're like always in between the, you know.
Let's take a break and hear a word from our sponsor. This episode is sponsored by Silent Media. You are creating an exciting world, but are the players truly connecting with your story? Audio is the main line to your player's emotional core. Good or bad game audio can often be the difference between a player continuing in their journey or giving up. At Silent Media, they know game audio. They've been through challenges before, and they want to help. So you can book a free game audio strategy session to tell them more about what you're working on. Go ahead and go to silentmedia.com/booking, spelled S-I-L-E-N media.com/booking. Look, guys, audio is one of those things that can be very difficult. You have no idea what to do with it. Now you don't have to figure it out on your own, especially if you're an indie company or if you're working with a small group. You guys already have your plates full of responsibility. So why not seek a professional help on a very important part of your game? Go to silentmedia.com right now /booking and give it a try. Just meet the guys over there and just see what you can end up with. I think you're going to be pleasantly surprised. All right, back to our episode.
That's exactly right. I think that most...
But maybe that's not naive. I don't know.
No, it's true. I think you hit the heart to the problem to most game development being too long. There's no reason why games should take 5 to 8 years. And when you talk to a team that is stuck in that cycle, it's mostly because of throwaway work or the iteration time is so slow and it burns out people when they have to throw things out and do it over again. So the only way to kind of correct that, there's only two ways, right? The managers have to be better at nailing their vision first try, which isn't going to happen.
Or the tools have to be fast enough so that it doesn't feel like a sacrifice in time and content every time something else needs to be generated new. And I think that's the direction the industry is moving and learning from to be better at making games. So I think everything that you're doing with all the companies have been a great improvement in that.
I mean, after I spent about 1 year in the industry and started to, realize, like, initially you almost cannot believe it that so much content is being thrown away.
Oh yeah.
It's once you realize it's almost mind boggling. I mean, it's like, it would be cool to live in an alternative universe where all the games that got scrapped got made and then you could try them out. It's probably a lot of great stuff there that never made it. And I just can't imagine the pain of working on something. You know, some project work for 5 years and it gets canceled and you can't show anything that you did.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's even worse. I haven't personally went through that, but of course, we all know friends that did.
I don't know if any other industry has anything, similar.
I think all parts of entertainment has something like that. I mean, we've heard movies being scrapped. I mean, I'm sure there's music. Movies are probably our closest cousin in terms of just scrapped work. But I've only gone as far as getting my levels cut, and that hurt enough. And the unfortunate thing is, when we talk about seasoned developers, are people who are kind of used to that and kind of muffle that part of their creativity going forward to move forward. And it kind of, it's a detachment mechanism basically. Oh, well, I'll get cut. Well, on to the next thing. I'll try not to care as much.
Yeah, exactly. How do you restart your creative and passion once you build something that you love and then it just gets thrown out?
You just got to be detached. I mean, at some point, you put your heart and soul in something, and that's when it hurts the most, when things do get cut or it's not restarted.
But also the different reasons I've heard of things being cut, it's like...
It's nothing to do with you, yeah.
It's not even a good reason. Like, it's like, someone rewrote the story. It's like,
someone
okay, but
the
can you?
It's always a running joke with at least environment artists, because I feel environment artists throw away the most stuff. I don't know. I don't know how anyone else can compete with us, because we literally build the world and throw it away, right? So. You might have a character here and there, but I can't imagine anyone throwing more stuff than us. And so the running joke with us has always been designers and narrative writers, right? Because whenever they have a new thought, a whole world gets kind of tossed aside. A lot of months and years even kind of just thrown for the betterment of the game, right? Betterment of the game. But I think what we're talking about here is really relevant. It's a pattern that I've been seeing for years, where everything is moving towards proceduralism, just bettering, fastering, less people type of thing. I would love to kind of dive in a little history of your Quixote days, because it seems like it informed a lot of your decisions going forward, and it was a learning journey for you of confirming yourself as an investor in the world of games, right? At least game tech. So from your day one of it sounded like what you saw was impressive, but also your instincts too of being ahead of the curve of, this is new, but no one's paying attention to it. There's a huge upside to this. I'm going to get on this. From then on, how did your role evolve? I mean, what kind of things? Because at that time, I'm assuming that you were just being introduced, right? You did your own studying, but like being in the trenches now, you're probably learning a lot more about games in general, right?
Yeah, I mean, Teddy and Vakar were such impressive. Teddy has been, there is a great interview you guys did with Teddy where he goes over the history, but basically scanning was everything he'd been doing since he was like 10. So, and Vakar was this amazing entrepreneur who was running a big company in Pakistan. So they were able to build that. So it was just such a super team of founders, who are super, super dedicated and probably the best in the world at what they were doing, but they were just overwhelmed, understaffed. And so we took in a bit of funding, and I was mostly working on the funding side. I mean, I briefly had the title as CFO, but replaced myself with someone better, and just basically we're just making sure if we needed to raise money, we were able to do that at a good valuation, and if there was interest from others to acquire the company, to negotiate around those terms and see what would be the best outcome for the shareholders, we had some some just financial shareholders wanted maximum return. Mm-hmm. And the founders, they had the more, they also had, I think money was almost secondary to them.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. that's why the Epic transaction was so, if I may say epic, because I've never, because they made it free, which was like, how often do you see an M&A and then the acquired company is now free? So it was a cultural fit. And but going back to your question, I think initially getting people to use photogrammetry was not as easy as it looks now. A lot of people had their pipelines, a lot of people were working I don't know what I should call it, manually or non-photogrammetric pipelines. And but once some of the big guys started using it, many people just
just followed,
joined up. I mean, now it's almost difficult to think about that there was opposition or doubt about photogrammetry ever being in a pipeline. But now it's pretty common, or now I guess it's standard.
Yeah. It's definitely a shifting mindset for a lot of people. I myself was in that transitional phase. I think it was early 2016 or something. Mm-hmm. And it was just right after Battlefield was the big photogrammetry is here. Everyone should use it. And so we were working on COD, and we were just, doing our own scans and trying to investigate, how this fits in our current pipeline. And yeah, I think there was a big mixture of, the younger guys and gals being all up for it and being very interested. And the older people who have their set pipelines didn't want to mess with that and saw it as a threat, maybe, or not as, it's not good enough. I can probably make this in designer faster or whatever, right? And not getting the potential of it. So yeah, there was a weird phase for a few years. I think, like he said, it's kind of, if you're making a realistic game, you should be using photogrammetry. Why are you sculpting rocks, right? It seems almost dumb. It is dumb for you to waste your time ZBrushing that, right? But it seems to be the factor, and we just had Luis Carell, who worked at Side Effects for a long time on Houdini stuff, and it was one of those factors where we kind of came to the conclusion, because of the big guys, for the industry to really change, the big guys have to adopt it first, and then it kind of spreads and throughout, right? The problem with the big guys is that they are 5-8 year machines. And most of the research and new tool developments are happening at the beginning of their cycle. So you're going to have to wait for like the next PlayStation for things to basically get picked up. And so fortunately, we didn't have to wait that long. It was around that time where big studios were adopting it. And it was introduced mostly too. It seemed like it mostly got introduced by hobbyists or junior developers, right? That were toying with all these different ideas. But yeah, it's a funny thing to kind of take a look back at how technology our jumps are made. And it's usually not from seasoned developers, which is odd, but it has to be for the industry to kind of adopt everything.
I think with 3D artist tools, there's a, it's easier to put them in the pipeline within you know, during a project. I mean, it's not easy, but it's it's easier. You can if you're making a photorealistic game, you can start using Megascans even, you know, a few years in. But for some other tools like Elias software, which is an audio tool, which is like it's a, you know, it's a runtime software, which is, you know, it's, it has to run in the game to play all the stuff that you can only implement at the beginning of a new game developer. So, you know, if we're speaking to people now, we have, you know, we have to wait until they're starting a new game where they can look at the pipeline. So getting in, and this was similar to Quixel. It's a bit of a runway even to be adopted.
You talked about your time starting with a few guys and your initial investing in Quixel, and then finally the big celebration when Epic acquired you guys, right? In 3 years sounds like a short time frame, but I'm sure that it felt longer while you're going through it with a lot of uncertainty, right? Like the problem with games is that if investors don't see it every day, monthly revenue, you know, cash flow being a big part of it, they start questioning it, right? And it's hard to prove it even more if they don't understand the lingo and what you guys are doing, or entrenched in the game industry to understand how big this will be. What are those kind of like daily challenges being like the main guy connecting funders to get funded? What kind of conversations that you think would be helpful for people who are looking to get invest to kind of get on the same page here?
I think something that is tough in this segment, which it's partially beneficial to me, it's that the so-called total addressable market, or kind of how big you can become. It's, you know, VCs, big VCs, you know, they want businesses they can be like multi-billion dollar businesses. And if I'm going to be honest, if you're a tool, how many 3D artists that are ready to pay for a tool are there globally? You know, maybe five, maybe there will be 10, but it's not Spotify. And most VCs, they want that, you know, unlimited upside, and here, yeah, you can make 10x return, but maybe not 100x, and then it's these companies are small, often small to start off with. So a big venture capital investor who's like minimum investment is $10 million, it's going to be too small for them to start with, and the upside is going to be too capped, because at the end, you can only sell to every game studio in the world, and that's something still that you can kind of count, or at least every AAA, AA studio. So that is always tough to kind of explain to them that, because they, I mean, we had some stuff about Quixel, you know, becoming a marketplace, but for your product, you're kind of restricted to the industry, and you have to find those investors that are fine with that. That's mostly angel investors or very small VCs. And then in business to business technology, it's also you have to spend a lot of time to understand it. Maybe it's just going to be a small investment, so people don't want to spend the time. I mean, just understanding something like a game audio system and no code like Elias or even Quixel, it takes a lot of time to understand the value. But lucky for Quixel, we did have like increasing revenue all the time, so we had the fortune never to be super stressed about getting new funding or even being sold, because we were steadily growing.
I would love to kind of talk a bit about that, because you know, talking to Teddy and knowing what the goal is now has always been about Megascans and creating that library. But along the way, was it always a plan to have Endu, Dedu, all that software updates and stuff to kind of continue the cash flow to fund the big project? Or was it just one of those things during development? It's like, hey, we need to appease shareholders to come out with something to meanwhile fund the bigger thing. I think this question overall is helpful for startups to kind of consider because, yeah, it might take a while to get the bigger thing. At the same time, you're more attractive. You have these little grand goals to show and prove technology as you're going.
Yeah, the thing is, I try to find founders which I invest in where I don't have to make those decisions. If I remember correctly, I don't want to kind of misquote him, but I think Teddy said, and that's my remember, that, you know, Megascans was always the plan and the other was just to fund it. From an investor point of view, I think what attracted everyone was, you know, the idea that, of course, not everyone should make a stone each time they make a game. We should have the biggest library in the world. So I think kind of the metrics we used for, you know, is the company doing well or not, was a number of assets in the library and how often they got downloaded.
Mm-hmm. That's definitely a huge proponent to that. I think that has helped all products to kind of be better. I think the quality in games, mm-hmm. especially from indie and AAA developers, have risen.
Yeah, I think it's, so just back to your question again, I think it's, if it's important to find metrics that you can focus on that are not necessarily tied to your revenue, because also we were thinking about this as a platform, you know, as a strategic asset in the industry, and then, you know, our revenue last month shouldn't matter that much, and that's why we focus a lot on assets and asset, and that was also a metric we could control. You know, we could hire more people to build scanners, more people to go out scanning, have more scan trips. So ideally you want a metric that you have an influence over, because the sales, it's almost like secondary.
Well, speaking of building metrics, right? I know game content is not your forte, but I'm sure you have friends that are investing in game content. Still, right?
Absolutely.
And on that side, it's always, even to me, a guy who produces content and trying to get out of my shoes to put myself on the other side, it's still a risky business, because in the end, you're a variable, and I mean, you can believe in your product as much as you want, but you don't know until it's out there.
I don't know how it. I mean, I think mobile gaming, it's become more almost like a quantitative business. So yeah. I almost don't see that as a content business anymore.
Yeah.
But on the content side, I mean, it's how you've seen this game Valheim from a Swedish studio. I mean, it was one guy for, I think, the first 2 or 3 years, and then he hired, like, so, I mean, I think the team at release was like 3 or 4. It's pretty fun if you start a game and go into the credits. The team that made the game, it's like 4 people. And then you have like the publisher and the other teams, they are like 5 times as many people. Yeah. Could anyone have predicted that game selling? I think it's past 5 million.
5 million sales.
Copies now. I mean, it's sold more than many AAA game, and then on the other end you have what's Cliff Bezinski, what's the game he made,
Lawbreakers. Yeah,
Lawbreakers was like, on paper, I mean if I would have been an investor and asked to invest in his studio, and it's like, it's him, it's Lawbreakers, it's like, I 100% I would have invested back then. And then I don't know, I think it came out the same as PUBG, and it had like, you know, 100 player CCU, and it got canceled in it. So having those one hit contents, it's super difficult. I mean, I don't even know how you would start to judge that. That's why I'm trying to keeping away from that.
Yeah, it's obviously you haven't figured out how to do it. Otherwise, you would be in it. And I'm just trying to understand, because there seems to be some formula going on. I think the mobile business, like you said, is the exact opposite of this issue, right? They figured it out. They know exactly day one revenue, where it should be to day 360 after release, right? And it's no mystery. I mean, I worked at a mobile company just to kind of feel and see what's going on. And they are a whole different thinking beast. You have like graduates from Stanford and Harvard sitting. It's like, wait, this is a game company? Why is all these smart people? And all they do is just look at statistics and analyzing behavior and tweaking a few things and looking at results quantitatively, you know? And it was a very different approach to game design. And then the game content team is a lot smaller than the people doing the numbers. So I was like, oh, maybe this is the future. This is the way. And so you're starting to see that bleed into games like Fortnite, PUBG, who are starting to think like that. I don't think there may be a few AAA companies that are completely mobile centric, right? Where maybe a EA company, I don't know. But when you talk about a large swath of AAA companies, they don't think like mobile, not yet, right? Starting to, but not yet. So there's two sides of this coin where I feel like there's one side that completely nailed game content being a very investing quality thing where they can guess what's next, but then there's the other side where it's still like a gamble and a lottery, which I don't get. Where how come someone hasn't sit down with both sides and figure this out? Because it seems like we figured it out. It's just no one's talking to each other.
I don't know. I don't know if it's ever gonna. I mean, you've worked there, so for a certain part of the AAA industry, yeah, I think it's still art. So I don't know if it's ever possible to, like Valheim, or if it's ever possible to get that down to a formula. Obviously, if you're maybe kind of, I guess, release, I mean, you can work with what do you call it? Like, you know, you have test groups and QA and all that, but some games like, you know, Control recently, which I like, it's like, it's an amazing art statement, I think also. And I hope that's always going to be like that for a certain section of the games. I always see, I see the big game. I mean, when I look at Cyberpunk or I look at Red Dead Redemption 2, I think this is probably one of the largest art projects in human history. I mean, I don't know how, maybe more people worked on the pyramids, but like, what other art project brings together this many people? So whenever people complain, I'm like, hey, come on.
I know.
It's such an amazing, amazing thing still that those things are real.
Yeah, it's very, it's a very hard struggle, I think, as a content creator to have something like Red Dead, where it's literally blood, sweat, and tears. I feel like it's only can be built that way. And imagine if you take the mobile approach of daily revenue and stuff. I think it will ruin that development very quickly.
When I stand in on a hill in Cyberpunk and I look across the city and I think about, you know, I can actually go there and there is stuff going on there. And I mean, if I would have imagined that when I was like 10, that's going to be possible, I could not have believed it. And then when I think about all the really, really cutting edge technology that goes into there, you know, everything from, you know, the GPU, you know, real, you know, what do you call it? DLSS, you know, this AI, you know, guessing what's the resolution or guessing how the picture looks at high resolution to make it run smoother. It's like, it's insane. You know, we're using all this cutting edge technology to deliver this really, really amazing art. So yeah, I like to make kind of even, you know, better artistic tools.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it definitely is a safest bet. If you were going the games, and it seems like you're very well versed on that side of the sector. So it only makes sense that you continue to do so. What word of advice would you have for people who are starting, has a startup, doesn't have that portfolio of IPs to kind of make a safe pitch, but there's obviously a lot of companies that are like them that are getting through the front door and getting it across, right? And there seems to be the right people on the other side of the door ready to put their money in and help them out, right? And invest and see there's an uptake, What do you say in general that they should position themselves at? Like, how should they go about it if they are ready to take those next steps?
I think there are still quite a few game technology companies that are underfunded. They mm-hmm. could grow quicker and get to their goal quicker if they raised funding, but they haven't. And I think it has been very difficult. It's probably going to be helped a bit with now kind of Unity being one of the first really they have a lot of advertising revenue, but it's still a game tool at some level. It's kind of made people understand that the tools also can be very, 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 very valuable. But I guess I'm trying to think of your question there. If you're a tools company, first you should contact me on Twitter. I think this narrative that with PlayStation 5, everyone is going to have, you know, create more stuff in less time with higher quality. And if you're helping out with that, you can be really valuable in the ecosystem. Maybe you haven't figured out your business model yet, but this is going to be, just get the users in. And then, the whole movie industry and everything is, if that's moving to Unreal Engine, I think every tool is just going to be five times more valuable.
Well, that's actually an interesting side topic here. So mm-hmm. we talk mostly games, but as you and I know, like entertainment businesses outside of games are starting to use all the tools. They're starting like Unreal, Unity, and of course, anything that comes to support those two. And they are very specific needs on that side too. They want everything even faster, iterative feedback happening within the editor or game time, being able to move things in the game, right? Kind of like a playing Sackboy and you're just live editing things, which is very unique to movies. Games don't have to have that type of iterative feedback unless the art director really wants to hover during a meeting and like move that right now. I need it now, right? So that's a very specific movie ask. With that part of the business coming, how do you see this evolving? Were there angles that you didn't see from before that you're like, wow, there's a whole new player. They have a lot of money. A lot of these studios want things and are recognizing game tools being important. Would love to kind of hear your perspective on that.
I think something that I... one thing that I've come to realize is that it's I think the network effects when in the past if you have had a career in maybe VFX within advertising or within Hollywood movies, you couldn't easily move into games or the other way around. Maybe if you were a lighting artist, I've heard many Hollywood lighting, physical lighting artists starting to work in game studios. But now if everyone is going to work in the same engine or everyone is moving to let's say Unreal, I think it's going to be amazing. It has to be an amazing boost for the whole segment that you can work in advertising, then go to movies, then go to games, seamlessly. So that should help everyone. Mm-hmm. And the fact that movies is moving that direction should just, I don't think we even, obviously it was used in the Jungle Book, but it's probably going to mega scans, but it's probably, you're going to see it, start seeing it more and more everywhere. Mm-hmm.
That's only great news for you, man. seeing things ahead of the curve. Speaking of which, and obviously you're helping with Polygon Flow. You're helping with Alaya software. What other exploration in the game tool sector that you feel like this is going to become the next big thing aside from those two? Like what part of the pipeline where you see and hearing from there's just this can be better in the horizon?
I haven't heard of anywhere. And maybe, I mean, I'm really not technically that smart, but something I've been thinking of, someone applying AI to NPCs in a better way. I feel that could be really interesting and potentially revolutionary for gameplay. There are a couple of apps on the phone which uses like an AI kind of connected to the internet, which you can almost freely chat with, but you know, it's not always the most answer, but it's not a pre-scripted dialogue you're having like you have on a game where you only have three or four options. So I think, you know, maybe where you can somehow build characters, NPCs, where you can say whatever, and they have an AI which which connects to kind of a set of experiences that character has, mm-hmm. and it's responding to you. And so in a single player RPG, you could have like a super, super unique experience and, you know, build, I mean, like, wouldn't call it real, but cool, you know, unique relationship with the characters. So I think that's going to come, but I haven't seen anything out there. It would be cool if someone was doing something.
Well, there you go. If you want to play a game with Siri and Alexa, that sounds actually pretty cool. I think that is
the Siri. I mean, they're pretty bad, but even just, I would like to see someone just giving that a try, using kind of Siri type technology and having that on the NPCs, and just see what happens.
No, it's true. I think with multiplayer, we use mics mainly to communicate with live players. I think the same needs to be investigated for AI players within a game. AI is another sector that's been funny, right? Mm-hmm. We see a lot of people, like the movie industry and other industries, starting to use tools, but mm-hmm. I see a lot of former programmers at these AAA companies starting to work at AI companies for like mm-hmm. Elon Musk and stuff. Mm-hmm. So there is a correlation there for mm-hmm. for the advancements that we've had for NPC. Mm-hmm. I think it's been under appreciated until recently, where a lot of that relevant AI tech within games mm-hmm. is starting to kind of cross over to actual applications to mm-hmm. AI in the real world, which is funny. I don't think it's talked about enough how a lot of what our program has been doing for years are starting mm-hmm. to find some weight in the advancements mm-hmm.
Every time I read of it's mostly shooter games to say now we have a really, really good enemy AI, but it never really fools you that it could be human.
Yeah.
One cool application I saw was in a bicycle racing game where they for the AI which you are playing against, the AI was kind of self-trained through a neural network. So to my understanding, when you race, they could actually kind of make mistakes. Because if you're playing a racing game today, I think most racing games, the AI difficulty is just like how fast they are. It's not like they miss the breaking point and run off the track.
Yeah.
But if you're training it neurally, you can have more like human behavior like that. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, making it less perfect. Yeah, totally get you, man. Like, there's a lot of that crossover I'm seeing, you know, robotaxi being a thing of the future. I see a lot of my friends at these AI car companies basically building mm-hmm. worlds to kind of train and simulate the AI within the cars mm-hmm. For that scenario, just mm-hmm. AI driven training with game tech, which is a crazy lateral approach to a lot of the tools that we've been using today. Like, I never would have thought like 5 years ago that we have friends now in these like world changing companies doing the same thing they've been doing yesterday.
I came it from the opposite way. I thought all the industry used the same tools, like movies and games and everything. I kind of was shocked that if you work 10 years in movies, you can't just move to a game studio and have value.
Mostly. Yeah. Well, it seems to be happening now. So finally caught up with your initial noob perspective. But this is actually the part of the time we are at the hour mark where I kind of shut up, hand the mic over to you to shout out if you want people to connect with you somehow or not, or give attention to any cause or things that's happening in the world that you want. This time is yours.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I mean, if you are within the space of game technology and looking to start or have started something, you can. I have a homepage which has www.thegaminginvestor.com. So easy to remember. I have all my investments listed there, and you can contact me if you have any questions or want to pitch anything. I think, that's it.
All right, man. Well, thanks a lot, man, for stopping by my apartment. It was great to finally have you as I popped back in here.
Damn.
It was great to kind of finally, have you join the podcast, which is funny. I thought I've had you on before, but I guess I didn't. But nice to see you, man. And
thanks.
Have a good time in the pandemic. Hopefully things are all right.
Well, thanks.
All right. Thank you for listening to today's episode. If you are liking the podcast, go to the Apple iTunes store and give GameDev Unchained a 5-star rating. This will help spread the joy and love and exposure for the podcast, and we thank you very much. If you want to continue the conversation, go to our Discord, which can be found on our website, www.gamedevunchained.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at BlueChamps, BlueChamps. You want to catch these episodes live every Tuesdays and Thursdays, go to twitch.tv/blue_champs. Email me any of your concerns or questions that you want me to read aloud at the beginning of each episode at info@gamedevunchained.com. And if you want to further support us and help unlock the next feature, which is the voicemail feature, go to patreon.com/BlueChamps. This gives listeners a chance to kind of call in, leave a message for both me and the guests to answer your deepest, darkest questions and comment on your deepest, darkest secrets. Thank you, everybody.